really diligent efforts to prevent that happening. The Buddha referred to the mind already, this is 2,500 years ago, before modern distractions, as the monkey mind. So it's the natural tendency of the mind to wander all over the place. Now, because we don't see our minds in the same way that we can see and smell our bodies, very few people have a concept of mental hygiene in the way that they have a physical hygiene. So if you don't bathe very often, you become where you feel uncomfortable and your body will start to smell. That's the nature of the physical body, which means that most people are quite diligent about bathing. But nobody can see your mind. And you, unless you make a conscious effort to look at your mind, you won't see it either. And so we're very alienated from our minds. We're very unaware of the springs of our actions. We lie to ourselves, we're deluded, we consider ourselves far more rational than we actually are. And there are many, many studies these days to show this in a very practical and arguable way. I'll give you this is to kind of an entertaining, I think, example of how much less rational than we may think. This is not a matter of whether or not you study science. This is just normal and natural. A group of people were given two options. One option was a completely free weekend holiday in Paris, staying in a 5-star hotel, everything laid on, completely free. The second option was a completely free, all expenses paid, 5-star hotel, etc., etc., holiday in Rome. So you had to choose one or the other. So there was in the initial study, it was about 50-50. Half the people thought they'd like to go to Paris and see the Eiffel Tower, and half wanted to go to Rome and see all the things that Rome has to offer. Now, the next stage of this study, a third option was introduced. And the third option was you could have a weekend in Rome, all expenses paid, 5-star hotel, etc., etc., but you have to pay for the coffee. So now you have three choices rather than two. The initial group were asked to deal with these three options. Now, if we were completely rational beings, option number three would have no impact at all, because there's no value added to option two. Instead of getting everything for free in Rome, now you have to pay for coffee. So if we were rational beings, the second time this test was done, you'd get exactly the same result. 50% want to go to Paris, 50% go to Rome. But what happens is, in the second case, something like 80% of the people now want option two, Rome free. And only about 20%, or 20-something percent, still go for Paris. Suddenly, option two has become more attractive than option one, even though nothing has changed at all. And the reason being that option two, a completely free Rome, now seems more attractive because it has Rome with a penalty involved. It's not a not quite so attractive Rome. And so I just offer this as just one of hundreds of examples of ways in which we're unaware of how irrational our minds are. I have many, many examples of this to tell people who are rather proud of their rational powers, but time doesn't permit that right now. So what I'm proposing is that, generally speaking, we have very little understanding of what's going on in our minds. It's like someone who drives a car and has never opened the car. You know, they've always just depended on the garage. And then when, as long as the car's driving along, they're fine. But then when the car breaks down, they don't know what to do because they never learned about an engine and they don't know how a car works. And most of us are in that kind of state. So meditation is not just a way of just kind of blissing out and just forgetting all our troubles. What it's doing is providing us a tool in which we can understand ourselves more clearly and to develop skillful means of identifying and dealing with negative mental qualities and find ways of promoting and developing positive mental qualities. So it's providing us a technology, it's providing us a means of putting this GNA, these GNH values into action within ourselves, and only when we're able to do that, of course, are we able to model them. Now, the basic principle of the first stage of meditation is that the mind, in order to let go of its distractions and its usual preoccupations, needs an anchor. So you can't go from attaching and running after all these different moods and emotions to a point of objectless peace. The intermediate stages, you have to hold on to one thing and then let go of everything else except that one thing. So this is an important principle. So we are developing attention span, developing mindfulness of an object. Now, the object that I would recommend that you might like to try yourself is the breathing process. This is a valuable tool in many ways because everybody breathes. You know, it's not a Buddhist function of the human body. We're all breathing all the time. And it's a matter of merely focusing on something which we usually take for granted, except for when we're walking up a steep hill or when we have difficulties in breathing. So the sensation of the breath at a particular point in the body. Usually we'll use an area around the tip of the nose, but it's not a fixed thing. And it's wherever you can recognize, acknowledge, you feel the breath most clearly. So it might be nearer your lip, at the tip of your nose, even inside your nostril. It could even be somewhere else. It could be in your throat or in your chest. It's not important, but that's your workplace. That's where you're going to sustain your attention. And then you make the effort to sustain the attention for the whole duration of an in-breath and the whole duration of an out-breath. And what you'll find is that we're very good at the beginning of something, but then our attention gradually wanders off and we lose it. So you'll find immediately that you can't do it. And this is a very humbling and sobering fact, I would hope for all of us, that you have so little inner control, inner administration of your own mind, that you cannot even sustain attention on your breathing for more than a second or more at a time without your mind wandering off. And that's, a really terrible thing. How can we be spiritually mature people? How can we be developing values consistently and well and wisely if we have that little inner integrity and control? So what do we do about it? Well, nothing too esoteric or difficult. Is just very patiently bring your attention back to the breath. So it wanders away into the past, into the future, thinking about this and that, and And then you, once you realize, you stop and you return to the breath. So the breath is your anchor. Now, you start to observe all kinds of things about your mind through this simple practice. So I would compare it to looking at your mind or being self-aware in daily life is like trying to follow a rapidly moving object against a background of many different colors. It's very difficult to do that. But if you have a single color as a screen, and if you have a grid on it, then it's very much easier to follow a moving object. So the breath, the mindfulness of the breath, fulfills the function of a single colored screen in which you are able to recognize all the ways in which you are not peaceful. And this is an extremely important part of self-knowledge and self-awareness. So we begin to see for yourself the extent to which petty kind of desires and attachments, the craving for excitement and stimulation, how much that conditions your mind, the petty irritations and aversions, the laziness, the sloth, the torpor of the mind, the agitations in the mind, the doubts, all these things are rising and passing away again and again in your mind, and whenever they arise in your mind unobserved, then they will have an effect. But being aware of these negative qualities, not as my negative qualities, but simply aspects of nature which are now being revealed to the eye of awareness, then we learn how to let them go. And so many meditators can become discouraged. They say, I can't meditate, I'm not very good at it. You say, well, why? Well, before, you know, just a few seconds and my mind's gone off somewhere and I bring it back. But that's completely normal. And it's not that you're wasting your time when that occurs. You're developing a mental muscle. If your mind wanders, you realize that's a moment of awakening. It's a moment of enlightenment. And then you're willing to let go of the interest and the enjoyment of that thought, that fantasy, or whatever it might be, and return to the present moment. You're developing the quality of renunciation. So you're learning, you're sharpening your ability to observe what's going on in your mind. You're learning how to let go of negative emotions. You're developing the ability to re-establish your awareness in the present moment every time that your mind goes somewhere and you realize and you come back to your breath. And what you will notice in your daily life if you do this on a regular basis is that you become distracted less often. You become aware of distraction more quickly, and you are able to re-establish your attention in the present moment more easily. Now, in this effort to develop, attempt to lengthen the attention span, to create this state of inner, relaxed wakefulness, it is important to realize that you cannot use willpower and just drive negative thoughts out of your mind. That kind of aggressive approach won't work. The time of the Buddha, there was a young man of good family who ordained as a monk, and he was very devoted to practice, had so much faith. His name was Sona. And he had this idea of all you need is kind of devotion and faith and commitment and just sort of blast your way through all the obstacles. And he's sort of doing walking meditation, walking up and down for hour after hour after hour. Because he was very wealthy and he wasn't used to walking that way, he wasn't used to walking bare feet, he cut his feet to ribbons. And he said, keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And the Buddha realized what was going on, and the Buddha visited him. And the Buddha said to him, Sona, before you became a monk, did you like to play the lute, like a guitar, a musical instrument? And he said, yes, Lord, I did. And he said, when you played the lute, what would happen if the strings were too loose? And he said, well, you'd get a very bad sound. He said, what happened if you tightened the string too tight? And he said, the strings would snap. So how do you get a good sound from your musical instrument? Well, you have to tighten the strings just the right amount. Not too tight, not too loose. And the Buddha said, that's exactly how you meditate. Not too tight, not too loose. Another image to convey this idea for how you meditate is if you imagine a small bird in your hand. Now, if you were to hold that bird too tightly, you would hurt the bird or you might even kill it. But if you were to open your hand too much, the bird might fly away. So how would you hold that small bird? Just enough that it doesn't fly away, but not so tightly that you hurt the bird. That's how you hold your mind in meditation. But you can't just get like one state. Yeah, this is the just right state, and sustain that. Because in the course of meditation, your mind will be changing, and you have to be adjusting that tension. Maybe making it a little bit tighter or a little bit looser. And this is the art of meditation. Being able to develop skillful means to adjust the quality of your attention as situations change. As the mind becomes calmer, the breath will change, it become very, very subtle, almost disappear. For some people, the breath can disappear altogether. So there are many different experiences in meditation. Now, time doesn't permit me I've already gone over the time I meant to do. Just a few more points about meditation. It's important to recognize that these kinds of hindrances we have in our mind are not us, they're not who we are. We don't have to feel bad or inferior. They're just normal conditioned phenomena that have arisen through habits created over many, many lifetimes, but that they can be removed through this practice of meditation. And if you persevere with meditation, the image here is of a dripping tap. To begin with, your awareness is like the water dropping from a tap. It's like drop, drip, drip, drip. And so the sound between the drips is when you're distracted. Now, as you practice more, the time that you're distracted becomes diminished, becomes less, and the mindful, bright, clear moments are increased. So it's now like your tap is drip, 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 drip. And then, finally, you have continuity of mindfulness. You are totally awake, aware, relaxed. There is this balance of sharpness and relaxation and clarity and flexibility and stability of mind. And this is like a stream of water. And this is what we call samadhi or samatha or concentration. And it's this which provides the mental factors necessary for the higher levels of meditation where we're developing wisdom and insight. Now, if you have even a small experience of inner peace, it will transform your life. I would compare it to someone who's lived in a very unpleasant place, let's say in a slum, from the moment they're born, they never ever went anywhere else. All they know around them is this horrible, dirty, smelly, unpleasant, unkind place. But because they've never known anything different, they don't really think about it. And then one day, someone takes them by the hand and says, let's go for a walk. And they climb out of the slum, out of the town, out of the city, up into the mountains. And they're, suddenly they're on top of a mountain. And it's, this is fresh air. Oh, this is sky. Oh, this is nature. Oh, I just never imagined. And then the wisdom comes up, where I live my life is such a nasty, dirty, unpleasant place. You see, the insight into that unsatisfactoriness of the usual place can only come about when you have a new perspective on it, something to compare it with. And so when you have that comparison, then you begin to see, oh yes, anger, irritation, and jealousy, and confusion, and things. These are really such horrible things. I really don't want them in my life anymore. Unless you have seen non-greed, and non-hatred, and non-delusion, in at least in that form of a short period of inner peace, you can never really develop the tools to abandon them. So developing that inner peace gives you a great deal of self-confidence also. Oh, this is something I can do. It's not impossible. It's not just for lamas in the monastery. It's something anybody can do if you're willing to make the necessary effort. And I'm proposing here that this kind of inner work is absolutely indispensable for someone who wants to fully appreciate the wonder of being born as a human being and to experience and to, you know, we understand in Buddhism, before you can take birth as a human being, you have to create so much good karma over so many lifetimes. So that's just to be born one of these 7,000 million people on this planet. But to be born in a Buddhist country, in a Buddhist culture, or in a culture which supports mind training, or in a country which has a goal of gross national happiness, how much good karma have you created in the past? But that's just like the money you have, that's your foundation. The next thing is, what are you going to do with that? You know, where do you go from here? It's a foundation, but it's not a given. So I'm trying to explain that this sense of inner transformation will bring happiness and welfare to yourself, happiness and welfare to your families and communities and the country that you live in, and in your particular job and role and responsibility as teachers, the extent to which you can embody and model this transformation will very much affect the extent to which you can instill it in your pupils. So I would like to end my talk at this point. Yes, so we have, although I spoke longer than I intended, we do have some time for questions. If anyone would like to ask anything or would like to teach me anything, I'm interested to learn also. Results of meditation rather than the technique or method of meditation. When the mind is very mindful and very calm and stable, then it does not react in the same way to stimulus from the outside world. So something can impinge upon your ear, but there's not the usual reaction of like, dislike, or making a big story out of something. And similarly with the eye sees a form. I'd like just to tell a short anecdote. When my teacher, my guru in Thailand, has many Western disciples, and when the first a group of monks trained in Thailand were invited to England to establish a monastery in England. They started off for the first few months, the first year, they were living in the centre of London. They were looking for a forest to build a forest monastery like we have in Thailand. But in the meantime, they were in London. And the temple was on quite a busy street. And opposite a pub, where it was often the loud rock music. And after they'd been there for some time, our teacher went to visit. And in the evening meditation period, there was a party in the pub. And so there was loud music and singing. And then at the end of the meditation, there was a question and answer session. And somebody said to my teacher, and said, very difficult for me to meditate because so many sounds disturbing my mind. And my teacher said, no, you misunderstand. It was not the sound disturbing your mind. Your mind was disturbing the sound. The sound is just a sound, you know. So don't let your mind disturb the sound. So that's similar to what you were saying.
When I wrote talking, this is based on the concept that we are practicing right now, I suppose. Throughout the country, probably the conception of GNH, educating for GNH, we came up with the concept of meditation classes. Probably children are asked to meditate whenever possible, even in the middle of a lesson, and they can already give their concentration. But then, knowing that meditation is an internal, sort of inner transformation, it sometimes becomes quite misleading for the young children, especially young mind. Because that would mean sometimes giving them a time to think something different than what you are actually asking them to do.
Yeah.
So sometimes what we understand is that we are, in some cases, in a way we are trying to mislead them with the principle of meditation and making them think something different than what we are trying to convert them to. So we are not very sure of what should be a crucial spark in their life that could really lead to a inner transformation, and then understand meditation is a complete concept rather than taking a very misleading way.